welcoming high schooler Emma and her mom Beth to the podcast.
Emma is a longtime patient of mine. I identified her hearing loss when she was 2 years old. Now she's in high school, and we've guided her from her first set of hearing aids through cochlear implantation, and we're going to explore her journey today. She's a patient that's really important to me. If you ask any clinician, they'll all have a handful of cases that are just different for them. And she's one of those patients for me where her success is a little bit more special. Her story is a little bit more meaningful. And it doesn't take anything away from any of the other patients we see. It's just that her story resonates with me. And I thought her story would be really interesting for you all to hear. All right. Welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast. Today, we're sitting with Beth and Emma, and we're going to hear their story and journey with cochlear implantation. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what your process has been like with hearing loss, hearing aids, cochlear implants, wherever you want to start.
You want me to start, Em? Should I hold this?
Just to be close to it is fine.
Well, Emma was officially diagnosed by you when she was 4 years old. When she was about three, we kind of questioned it. Her preschool teacher had mentioned something one day that when he speaks to her, sometimes it takes a minute for her to respond. And, you know, he was like, I don't know if it's her hearing or, you know, just she was missing me. I don't know. But it was something that we listened to, we looked into, and we had made an appointment with her pediatrician to get her ears checked, you know, well, get a checkup, but also they did, it looked like the in-ear thermometers, they tested right in the office. And it was funny because when they did that, it didn't come up. Mm-hmm. They weren't getting a reading. And then all of a sudden it was fine. So we put it on the back burner, didn't think about it, thought it was normal and, you know, went on with life, you know, everything seemed normal. And then when she was in preschool, pre-K-4, her teacher had come up to us one day and said something about her speech. We're like, we don't know so much speech, but we do think in question her hearing sometimes. So back to the pediatrician, they did that test again. She failed it. And that's how we found ourselves in your office. So that was the beginning. And I'll never forget that day because she went through, she had, I guess she met with the ENT first.
Yes.
She made sure, you know, there wasn't any damage, fluid in the ears, all the things that could, you know, make a kid hard of hearing.
The common things,
you know, ear infections. She never had an ear infection growing up. I think she's had two her whole life, and it was from swimming in the pool. And she went in. She went into the booth. She was all a four. And I think I went in with her.
Probably.
She was sitting on my lap, and I'll never forget, I came out, and you're like, she needs hearing aids. She needs them bad. And I feel like everything else just went, like, away. And you're talking through the process. We were going to go to RWJ to get a second opinion. And I'm just sitting there thinking in my head, oh, my gosh, she's never going to be able to drive. Oh, my gosh, you know, kids are going to make fun of her. You know, what else is this going to hold back from her life? And I didn't believe it. You know, I'm like, well, she's four. You know, she didn't know that what she was listening to or what to listen for. But as it turned out, when we went to the visit with RWJ, she was very reliable with her testing. And they confirmed that she did, in fact, need hearing aids. And that's where our journey really began.
Yeah, and a couple things to mention on that front. At the time, I was younger in this, and I liked the idea of her going to a hospital-based clinic where they had a larger booth, and there would potentially be two audiologists to work with her just to make sure we were crossing all our T's, dotting all our I's, to make sure that, yes, the hearing loss that we're observing is, in fact, what it is. And one thing that I also wanted to mention based on the pediatrician screening test, there are a few different screeners that are done at pediatricians, and the most common thing that pediatricians will see patients for is for ear infections.
Right.
And a lot of times the screener that we'll do will check eardrum movement, which will be the indicator of if there's fluid or not. And sometimes it can be overinterpreted to say, oh, everything's fine, because what they most commonly encounter, you weren't showing. So it's very important to know what the screening test is, and also to know that screening tests don't catch everything. Every year, we probably identify a couple kids where their hearing loss was missed by screening tests because I shouldn't call it a
Not
screening
every
test, by a
screener
screening.
catches everything.
Exactly. And there are certain hearing losses that no matter what screener you use, you're going to miss it. So if you have suspicion as a parent, it's always good to follow through with that.
And that's great. That's brand new information to me. I didn't even know that, so.
Yeah.
How was the start for when she first started wearing hearing aids? How was that adjustment period?
Oh, it was funny. And it was kind of weird because at that point we had gone to see a different audiologist because we didn't know that we could come back to you. And actually we came back in a roundabout way. But when we went through the process, she had them, and it was like, when you get glasses, like me, that's the only way I can relate. I started wearing glasses when I was 10, so it was like, okay, wear them for 2 hours, then give your eyes a rest, and so on. And it was the same thing for her, but she was sort of resistant. She didn't want to do it because, in true Emma fashion, everything, she's headstrong, and that was
Good for
life for
you.
her. Yeah, that was life for her. So she didn't know. It was weird, but she would have
It's
to
her
wear them.
normal.
Yeah, she would wear them for a few hours and take them off. And she didn't initially go into preschool with them on. We were doing it at home to make that transition. And then actually, she was just writing a paper about her first experience when she was doing that whole, breaking them in period and what became very, I guess, pivotal for her was when she was doing macaroni art and she realized she needed to wear them all the time.
Do you have memories of when you first started with them?
Yeah, so when I was in preschool that day and we were doing like stations and we were doing macaroni art for Father's Day, and I just remember like we were just sitting there and she was explaining everything. And all the kids were doing it, and I just couldn't understand why I couldn't hear her. All of a sudden, it was like I just couldn't hear her at all because I was wearing them at home and then going to school not wearing them. So it was just such a difference for me. And then that was like the day like I came home crying. I was like, I need to wear these in school. Like I can't hear.
One of the funniest memories, and it's the little things that you don't realize. She has always been very great at lip reading. We always call it her superpower. And that's why, you wind up feeling guilty. We're like, how did we miss this? But she was so fixated on our faces. But that was just life, like this is how she spoke, like you could say anything and she spoke clearly. But once she had her hearing aids, I'll never forget, I had her riding her bike around our neighborhood, and there was a dog and a house across the street that was barking, and she was like, "Hey, doggy, stop woofing at me." And I'm like, I didn't realize those are things that she never heard before, or having the water on in the sink. She was like, "What's that noise?" And I didn't realize these are things that she was missing in everyday life, but she didn't realize she was missing it. So it
And
was.
probably with that macaroni art, now that her brain had a basis of comparison of what it's like to hear at home but not in school, it even makes it more impactful there.
And I'm actually curious if you go back to when we first said she has hearing loss, needs hearing aids. Was it too much information that day?
Oh, it was so much information. And I don't know that it was an overload on you. It just, as a parent, if anything with your kids, like you kind of, go into like fight or flight mode and, panic and, anxiety starts taking over in your brain. So yeah, you kind of don't really process anything that's going on. But I don't think, I think what you were so, I don't want to say passionate about it, but like, you knew that she really, really needed them and could benefit. And you probably have seen parents or come across people that just don't believe it and leave your office like thinking, okay, they just want me to buy hearing aids.
Yeah,
So.
there's a wide range of response that we will get to that news. One of the things that we've started to do is because it's so much information and a lot of times parents are not in a position to hear it in that moment, is have the child come back a week later, repeat the test, and within that appointment, schedule time to really sit down and talk. Now that there's been a little bit of time to digest the information, recognize, hey, maybe this is the new reality,
right?
And then really be able to process it. Because for many parents, what you described is not unusual, that it's almost like you shut down. You hear yeah. something is wrong and message is not received after that.
Correct.
So, and we've received so many types of reactions, whether it's denial or it's emotional, inquisitive, or just not knowing what to say at all.
Check, check, check,
yeah.
check.
Yeah, it seems to be that there's a lot of similarities in the experience for parents. And it's important for clinicians, especially younger clinicians, to recognize that, as we've said in other podcasts, you're kind of dropping a bomb on people's lives, and you need to respect that that is a big deal and be empathetic with that process. Because if you're not, your message is certainly not going to get heard, and that will be to the detriment of the care of the child.
Sure.
Because the parents have to trust you. They have to be comfortable with you to put the care of their child in your hands with something that is this big.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you guys have always been really good and, you know, as far as, you know, having that empathy and, you know, always being available. I know, like, mm-hmm. any questions, you know, over the years, you know, you've always been, you know,
we expect
quick to help.
We expect yeah. questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know,
it's a whole new life.
Yeah. And unless you're going through it, you can't relate to it. Right. And you can't say, well, this is because of this and this is because of that, you know.
Do you have any recollection of when we started to have the conversations about cochlear implants?
Yeah, so I was also writing in my paper the other day. It was, like, about my whole, like, story. Uh-huh. So I was just writing this. I was just, like, remembered everything the other day.
What good timing for this podcast.
Yeah. And I just remember, like, the doctor's appointment. She wasn't there. It was just me and my dad because she had the flu.
And normally I was at every single appointment because I need to know firsthand what's going on.
Yeah. And I just remember going through the test that day, and it was just like, it seemed normal because I knew I was hearing less at that point, but I thought you were just going to adjust the volume again and then I was just going to go on about it, because I was coming in pretty regularly at that point to get it checked. But then you, like, kind of talked for longer that day, and I didn't really know what was going on. I probably really wasn't listening to you or didn't hear you. And I just remember, like, my dad was more concerned, and then it just became, like, a big conversation, and I just heard surgery just being mentioned over and over, and I was like, okay, this sounds a little more serious than normal. But that's all I really remember about it, mm-hmm. is that it was just more serious than an average visit.
Eric, do you remember how old she was?
I think this conversation probably started around when she turned 8, maybe a
yes.
little earlier.
When she had turned 8, at that point, her hearing had started to drop off. Like, it was stable for a while, mm-hmm. and it always went down and came back
yeah.
up. And everyone's always like, that's, like, her, you know, mm-hmm. what was, like, her saving grace. But it kept going down. And so we had started doing visits every 3 months. And it was changing every time mm-hmm. we came in. So, yeah, that was probably around 8. And then that visit happened to be, I just know it because it was my sister's birthday and I was sick. That was March, and she turned 9 in April. So, and then her surgery was scheduled that summer. So,
right. You were around July, right?
July 14th.
Because we wanted to have it done and activated before school started.
Yep. Mm-hmm. July 14th was surgery day.
Which was a whole nother complication with the devices after that also.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. Yes, I forgot about that part.
I don't know if I ever told you this. We'll tell this
story. Oh, I'm excited to hear.
Tell us a bit about what that appointment was like when we really sat down and talked about the CI process.
I guess the evaluation.
Yeah.
It was very overwhelming. You know, from the beginning, I thought a cochlear implant, like, that was the worst thing that could ever happen to her, mm-hmm. you know, that she's going deaf. And if there's a cure someday, if she has this done, then, you know, she's not going to benefit from the cure, not knowing that this was the cure, right. you know, all along. And I remember just going, like, I was a basket case, mm-hmm. you know. It was scary. I was thinking of all the things that she had to do, because I guess all the pre-op testing, like going, that was back, but we'll stay over here. Like, I guess she had to get her shots, like the meningitis mm-hmm. shot, yeah. which they accidentally gave her a pneumonia shot. And I'm so glad something made me say something about having the meningitis shot. She's like, what? I gave her Prevnar. And I'm like, No. And this was 2 weeks prior. It was a lot. It was just a lot to process at the time. But, you guys were great, like you with every step of the process. It was just, it made it, I mean, it wasn't easy, but it definitely helped a little bit. But, yeah, I don't know.
And at least from what Eric has told me, I believe Emma's our only pediatric cochlear implant recipient because Emma can report like an adult and was able to at age 8.
Even, and we had a lot of debate about this within our offices of does it, are we doing right by you if we keep you within our practice versus referring you out to a specific pediatric facility? And the way that you interacted with your hearing aids and the way that you reported what your experiences were gave us the confidence that we would be able to manage your case because we trusted how you were responding to us, the information you were giving to your parents, and that we would be able to give you what you needed. But it was because you did not report your experiences consistently with what your age was that really allowed us to keep in on your case and part of your care. One of the things I remember from the conversation about the evaluation is that we would say we have good options. And for a parent, even though a cochlear implant surgery is less involved than oftentimes people stereotypically think about it, they'll think of it as brain surgery and it's not. So it can oftentimes sound more overwhelming. And when they hear, oh, I'm going to go home the same day, oh, it can be a 3 hour or less procedure, it's not what's expected. But also in her case with surgery, there were some complications.
So after her surgery, she wound up having Bell's palsy. And through the whole about, they get MRI, and Dr. Kortler, he actually went through and he, told us what to expect, but and it was a whole, I remember that day, there was a whole he sat with us, all Q&As, like what we're asking, not thinking to ask stuff like that. But after her surgery, I remember that night she went home and she was fine, a little like she was a little dizzy because, I guess messing with the ear that makes you have vertigo. Not in that much pain. But well, actually no, you were in a little bit of pain, like her neck bothered her after. But I was looking at her, and my mother happened to be with us that night, and I was like, "Mom," I was like, "she looks like she had a stroke." I'm like, "What's going on?" So I called the hospital, and luckily, her post-op nurse was still there, and she put me right through with the doctor. And I said to him, "I'm like, when she's blinking, like her eye, it was taking time to, catch up with the other side." And I'm like, "It looks like she had a stroke." So he got on the phone with me. He was like, visually, he was like, "I know that the facial nerve was intact. It could be a thermal injury." So, she was on steroids, keep her on the steroids. And, I think our post-op was in a few days.
Yeah, usually they have you back
A
within a
week.
week.
And when we went up there, he did a test to make sure that everything was intact. But, she did have Bell's palsy, and, she was drooling when she was trying to talk, and, her eye was just wide open. And I remember, like, every day, taking pictures to see it was getting better. And I remember I called you hysterical one day. I was like, no one prepared me for this, but it wasn't something that we didn't, it wasn't something we thought to ask, and
So when it comes to reviewing potential complications, because both dizziness and Bell's palsy, which is a facial paralysis, where if you ever see somebody with an uneven face, that's what it is. Those are known potential complications. And this is something that's also important for the audiologist to recognize with the surgeon who's reviewing complications. Typically, it's going to be the surgeon. I like to get into it a little bit in the course of the evaluation because I don't want parents going into it thinking everything's going to be just fine. But if there's not communication between the audiologist and the surgeon, that can lead to information either being missed, or a lot of times on the surgeon's end, they'll give you a form that says these are potential complications, and the chart will get checked off as the complications were reviewed, and that's the end of
Right. It's
that.
so different than when you hand somebody a piece of paper and that can get lost in all the information you're
Oh,
hearing.
and how many times do you get handed pieces of paper though? You're just like, you
Sign it.
sign it and you just, you know, trust whatever's on there.
So they've covered themselves, but you don't necessarily feel informed as a patient. And I remember when you called me just thinking, whoa, one of the, I think, the biggest responsibilities we have is when we are recommending from an audiological perspective a surgical intervention for treatment, and then something goes wrong, even though I'm not the one with the blade and with the drill, it's still, there's a sense of responsibility in that. So once that happened, I remember requesting a copy of the CT scan and MRI, just like, hey, what's going on? And I remember you saying that the surgeon said this is going to improve. And I remember thinking, I sure hope so, because I've seen it go both ways. And when we reviewed her scans, what it said, when the surgery is actually being done, when we're in there in those procedures, there's a difference in what the bone looks like for the covering around the facial nerve. And in the imaging, it showed that her nerve was more exposed, which makes sense with a thermal injury because the drill is going to get hot. So if that's in proximity to an exposed nerve, there could be a temporary injury. And that's likely what happened in your case. But as a parent, that has to be terrifying. And for a child, if you even recognize what's happening within that. But certainly after that, I'm much more aware, even if I don't feel like it's wholly my responsibility to have that conversation. I want to make sure the parents know to ask the questions so that there isn't this sense of, wait a second, nobody told us that this could happen. And there's a reason why a lot of ENTs, your traditional ear, nose, and throat doctors, do not do a lot of ear surgeries and do not do cochlear implant surgery. And it's because of navigating the facial nerve. So the facial nerve goes through the areas around the middle ear space. And the last thing you want to do is injure that nerve because you could have a permanent effect from that. So that's why it's typically the otologist, who's the super specialist ENT who works with ears, that does these surgeries because they're working around the facial nerve much more frequently. But it doesn't mean this sort of complication can't happen. And from talking to surgeons, this is always their biggest fear in doing ear surgery, is the last thing you want to do, especially with a child, is leave them with a permanent complication that's affecting their facial function. So
For sure.
that was a big deal. And I remember it being about 3 weeks or so that it took to pretty much resolve.
Because surgery was July 14th, and then by the time she went back to school, it was, you know, probably I would say like 95% better. Like, I don't think it's 100%, but you know, I would think she's like 98%, you know, herself.
At the activation, I remember it was a lot better, but it wasn't. It was like you knew that there was something. And for me, there was kind of a discomfort in that activation because, like, wow, now you have to deal with this. And as much as we can say we think this is going to get better,
You don't
you
know.
don't know for sure. You know the nerve is intact based on the responses he was getting from the testing he did, but you don't know the extent of that permanent injury. And it's a
It's
scary
like this
thing.
cloud that's hanging over the activation.
And I think when we saw you for either the week or 2 week follow-up, there was some significant improvement from before that, which was a little bit of exhale. But it's a big deal when
You know, and it's funny to hear your perspective of it because, you know,
because we don't
you
usually
have,
say
yeah,
that.
no, you have to be like, calm, cool, like everything's gonna be fine, everything's gonna be fine, and, you know, because I'm over here, you know, like, you know, the world's falling apart. But I remember, like, I did wind up keeping her on her steroid longer because I'm like, what's it gonna hurt? You know, she had extra left over, and I'm like, what's it gonna hurt? And I massaged her face every day because I'm like, I'm doing everything I can to make sure this gets better. And I think we did good.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.